I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the distinguished professor Michael Morgan, one of the finest Jewish studies academics in the world, discussing Jewish belief in the 21st century. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I had a very interesting discussion with a group of rabbis last week on a curious subject, the way that some Jews we encounter seem to have a genuine hostility towards synagogues and rabbis. I've encountered it in hospital rooms and at meetings, and other rabbis have seen it in various places in the community that we all serve. It's a puzzling phenomenon, and more widespread than you might expect. Jews who don't pay dues to a synagogue and have no regular connection to a rabbi, and who often have no real involvement with the Jewish community at all, nonetheless bear animus towards organized Judaism. Might be that I just have this backwards, that something genuinely bad happened to each and every one of these people along the way, and they simply then opted out of institutional Jewish involvement and commitment. Maybe they were traumatized by a mean rabbi or a bad Hebrew school teacher. Perhaps they were frightened in their youth at an upsetting Purim carnival. Could be that a cantor's voice was so horrifying it destroyed their appreciation for music, or that a dastardly executive director actually forced them to pay temple dues. Who knows what horrors were perpetrated on these people in the name of organized Judaism, but for one reason or another, overactive air conditioning systems at the high holidays gave people pneumonia? A lot of Jews today seem to be angry at organized Judaism. Now, I'm not talking about dissatisfied or disappointed or bored with the services or the rabbis or cantors or temples. I'm talking about the mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore kind of anger. The meeting here in Tucson I had was with the Board of Rabbis, and all of us recognize the experience of hearing genuine anger from some unaffiliated Jews. For years, I've been used to hearing why no one should actually have to pay any money to belong to a synagogue or utilize our many services, classes, and life cycle events, often from people who might have been called in earlier times professional schnorrers. But in recent days, I've actually heard a genuine anger at synagogues that I just don't remember from my earlier days in this field. It's hard for us rabbis to fathom the source of this, of course, since every one of the people in that room was doing their level best to make temples and congregations caring, committed, intellectually fulfilling places where good values are taught and modeled. We all work long days, at least 6 days a week, and we are all trying to serve the needs of the Jewish people. Why would anyone have such anger towards what we're doing? I mean, we are rabbis, not lawyers. We aren't politicians or Wall Street insiders or tobacco executives, right? And synagogues aren't health insurance companies or oil cartels or the U.S. Post Office. We are religious organizations trying to help people in a variety of ways, spiritually, educationally, socially, often at very low or no cost. In fact, we frequently help indigents and we're active in social causes throughout the community. Aren't we supposed to be the good guys? So why this anger? In our rabbinic discussion last week, the ideas ranged from the thought that some people really had genuinely poor memories from their own Jewish educational religious experiences in the past. Others, well, we thought that it was simply impossible to actually satisfy Jews, so of course some of them are going to be angry. Other rabbis thought that the institutional message that comes out from non-temple Jewish organizations is often, frankly, anti-synagogue and sometimes anti-rabbi. Others believe that people today are simply unaware of all the many things that temples offer, how warm and welcoming we strive to be, how hard we work to meet the needs of the people who seek us out. You know, I think there are elements of truth in every one of these explanations, from the 70-year-old guy I'll meet who remembers a miserable time he had in religious school 60 years ago, to a 65-year-old woman who never got called back from the temple she tried to take her kids to when she was a poor single mom back in the 1970s. Sometimes bad things do happen, but I also believe there's another factor at work. For better and for worse, temples and rabbis are the face of Judaism, and this is just as true in 21st century America as it was 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. The other ways we have of demonstrating Jewish identity, the so-called cultural Judaism or secular Judaism, the various forms of culinary and literary Jewish expression are all nice. But when it comes down to it, the only means of really continuing Jewish identity for more than one generation, at least outside the state of Israel, remains synagogue membership and participation and youth education. However, the other organizations we Jews so love to create and perpetuate use valuable resources, including talented leaders, who would otherwise go to the temples. In the meantime, the need for meaning and purpose, for spirituality and learning, actually grows in our society, and the place where that genuinely takes place is a synagogue, but we now have less to employ and more expectation of service. Which in a kind of unfortunate cycle means that rabbis and temples are trying to provide more and more with less and less, and that our people tend to expect more and more and don't really get it. Not least because they don't give enough to make it possible in time, money, and commitment. That pretty much guarantees there will be some unhappy folks out there who will leave when they don't get what they want and perhaps bear animus ever after. Okay, so this is not the most cheerful beginning to a show I have ever featured, I admit it. Again, I fail to satisfy. But it's an important part of understanding what it means to really be Jewish in America today in 2012, and to figure out what it is we need to do to try to fix it. Or, you could say, to be liberated from these unreasoning expectations. In that spirit of liberation, we are in the final 3 weeks before the great festival of Passover, Pesach. And so to play us in this morning, here's a Passover medley from my dad, Rabbi Enkander Baruch Kohan, and myself, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and our Generation to Generation CD, B'chol Dor V'Dor. In every generation, each Jew is responsible to see himself as though he or she personally had come forth from Egypt. And Shalach Ami, let my people go.
B'chol Dor V'Dor, Chayav Adam Lirot, Lirot et Atzmo Ke'ilo, Ke'ilu Yatsa Mim Mitzrayim.
Yadu ni, Yadu ni, Shalach Ami.
That was Cantor and Rabbi Baruch Kohan and me singing a pre-Passover medley for the coming Festival of Freedom. Our guest this morning is Dr. Michael Morgan, one of the finest Jewish studies professors in the world and an expert on Jewish thought. Find out some of the ways we think about God in the 21st century when we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments.
The other day, I was at a business networking breakfast, and I introduced myself to the fella sitting next to me by saying, "Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza." Without missing a beat, he said, "I know, you're the, now repeat after me guy." Well, it was clear he'd heard my commercials before, but the guy sitting next to us was a little puzzled. Obviously, he had no idea who I was. So I tried a little experiment. I asked the first guy to tell the second guy what he knew about Mama's just from hearing our commercials. "Easy," he said. "Mama's is a family-run restaurant that's been around Tucson a long time. One of the things they have is a huge pizza called the family size. Oh, and they pride themselves on having great atmosphere and value." So there, in about 10 seconds, this guy who had never heard of Mama's before basically knew the whole story. And now, so do you. Except that we have four convenient locations in Tucson. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Professor and Rabbi Michael Morgan. Dr. Morgan received his rabbinic ordination from HUCJIR, one of the really great institutions of rabbinic training since it's my alma mater, back in 1970. He got his doctoral degree in philosophy from the University of Toronto. He's one of the most prominent academics in the field of Jewish studies. He's the author of 16 books on subjects as diverse as Jewish thought after the Holocaust, modern Jewish philosophy, and moral and political theory. He has worked on a number of very prominent Jewish thinkers, and he can tell us what it is we should think in Jewish terms in the 21st century, right?
Well, I wish I could be as confident as the question makes it sound. I like to think that having done some reading and some thinking, I have a feel for what problems are of interest, but I'm not sure that I can tell anyone what they ought to think or what they must think.
You can't solve all of our problems that way.
No.
One of the most fascinating aspects of Jewish thought and modernity is kind of the wide range of choices we have, which I don't think was always the case. What changed and what gives us that capacity now?
Well, that's an excellent question, really. I think it probably is the case that in various periods in the past, certain works emerged as the most significant ones or ones that were most compelling and, maintained a kind of preeminence in the tradition. And so when they come to us, we look back on those periods and perhaps see those dominant works as casting a shadow over the whole period. And there's a lot else that was going on that suggests a lot of diversity in those periods as well. But it's certainly the case that I think in the 20th century, which I've been focusing a lot on, I think, in recent years anyway, there is a great deal of diversity thinking about Jewish life, thinking about Jewish experience, Jewish history, and the meaning of these things. One significant contribution is the complex and subtle ways in which Jewish thinkers personally and then intellectually have engaged with non-Jewish thinking as well as Jewish thinking. I think even within kind of narrower parameters, there have been some really important figures who differ on some very fundamental questions, and so you get a lot of diversity there. I'm thinking particularly, say, of the early 20th century, when I think in the period of World War One and afterwards, the Weimar period in Europe, that there's a tremendously exciting intellectual ferment that's going on, and a lot of the participants are Jewish. Some of the Jewish ones are really devoted to thinking about Judaism, some of them are not. But even though there's a kind of common vocabulary and a common discussion, at the same point time, important figures differ on really, really significant issues. So you have, say, Buber on the one hand, who has a very restricted or negative view about ritual practice and the formalism of ritual life. And Rosenzweig, who's close to Buber on a lot of things, nonetheless differs dramatically on the importance and the significance of ritual practice and what opportunities it provides.
We will talk much more with Professor Michael Morgan. He will be here as the Bill Gray Scholar in Residence and lecturer at University of Arizona in Temple Emmanuel, Thursday, March 22nd through Saturday, March 24th. We'll talk more with him when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two-bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, twojewishradio.com, or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as popular podcasts. Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is coming up quick, May 30th to June 10th of 2012. If you still want to go with me on this great journey to Israel, email twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and registration information as well. There is a new Haggadah out this year for Passover, the text that we use for the Pesach Seder, of course, the Haggadah. This one's called the New American Haggadah. It's been created by Jonathan Safran Foer, the author of Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, among other books, with a new translation by Nathan Englander, the guy who wrote the wonderful short story collection For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. It has commentaries by Jeffrey Goldberg and Lemony Snicket, among others. Stephen Colbert interviewed Jonathan Safran Foer on his show, The Colbert Report, and challenged him on the creation of yet another new version of this central tale.
Okay, so this is this story, but didn't this story already exist? It's called Exodus.
Yeah, it's
so you think you can improve on Moses? You got some matzo balls, buddy.
Yeah. So, in fact, this is probably, of all books ever written, the one that's been revised the most times. There are about 7,000 editions of it that have been created. Wherever there have been Jews, whenever there have been Jews, there have been new Haggadahs.
Every single generation, there's a new Jew who says, I could do better. It's not bad, don't get me wrong.
Well, it's not doing better so much as tuning the instruments. So.
How do you tune these? Because the story goes, the Israelites are enslaved by Pharaoh. Right?
Right.
Who is forcing them to provide contraceptive coverage.
Yes.
In this entertaining interview, Colbert also made a special comment about the inclusion of a commentary from Lemony Snicket.
And we have commentaries from Jeffrey Goldberg, Lemony Snicket, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein.
Lemony Snicket.
Lemony Snicket.
Lemony Snicket. Well, that makes sense because Exodus is a series of unfortunate events.
That would have been a great title for the book.
Yes, it would have been. Yes.
Lots of fun with a new, very unusual Haggadah for Passover called the New American Haggadah. As the editor of a Haggadah myself, I have to agree with Jonathan Safran Foer. This is the most revised book in history, and each new Haggadah adds something unique to Passover, which makes Pesach a particularly unusual and special festival coming up. No matter which Haggadah you use, starts April 6th for a full week of matzah. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the One Tribe Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
We have a wonderful concert, a shared concert coming between American-Israeli artist Achinoam Nini Noah, the world music artist, and Mira Awad, the wonderful Palestinian singer. Tell us about how they started collaborating in this whole program and how it came about here.
Well, Noah and Mira Awad are amazing singers. I need to honestly say they're both actually Israeli. Only Mira
I should say
Awad,
an Israeli-Palestinian or Israeli-Arab.
She's an Israeli-Arab. She defines herself as a Palestinian. And it's funny because when you look at their pictures, most Americans think that she is Achinoam Nini. She's Noah because she has this European look.
She does look kind of European.
While Noah is Yemenite originally.
Right.
So she has a look that seems to be more Arabic. They're singing together, and they're fabulous. Noah was invited the other day to perform in front of the Pope in the Vatican, which is a very rare opportunity for a singer from any singer to come and perform there. They're going around the world, and they're kind of bringing a message of saying, you know what, there is another way. We can do it differently. We can do it differently, not through negotiations and not through treaties. And not through, you know, all those politics. The real way, according to them, to bring peace is by getting people together, get them talk, get them find the things that unite them, that are similar between them. And there are a lot of stuff that are similar between Arabs and Israelis. And I'm not talking only about the Palestinians. I'm talking about the entire Arab world. You know, if we look at the Arab world today, we're talking about approximately 400 million Arabs on an area of land that is bigger than the United States. And yet, if you look at Israelis and you say, well, they like the same kind of food, they have a lot of the same culture.
They like some of the same sounding music, for that matter.
They like the same kind of music many times. You know, there was an Israeli Arab singer, Sharif, who was very, very famous and very, very popular also in Arab countries. And of course, the famous Egyptian singer Umm Kulthum was very favored by Israeli audience. So yes, and what Noah and Mira Awad are doing in their concert, they're combining the ethnic theme of the music that comes from the Arab culture, from the Yemenite culture, into a more Western, modern, poppy in a way, classic in others, which turns out to be an amazing musical experience, really amazing. You sit there and you are inspired. You hear the music, you hear their bell-like voices, and it really lifts you up.
Really gorgeous. And they're going to be in Tucson, Arizona, in case you're in the neighborhood, the 25th at UA Presents at the Centennial Hall. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Now, this is a really obvious question to ask, but what's cooking at Janos?
Greatness, wonderful food, wonderful flavors, great experiences, beautiful atmosphere, terrific views. That's about it.
You know, I have to say, it is really one of the most magnificent restaurant experiences you can have, not just in the Southwest, but in the world.
Well, thanks, Rabbi. You know, we have three restaurants now, but Janos is the flagship. That's where we put everything into it. All the elegance, all of the love, all of the caring. That's the peak of what we do.
So for a very special night, or just because you want to have a spectacular meal, how can they get in touch with you?
Just give us a call, 615-6100. Go to our website, www.janos.com. We'll be happy to see you.
That's janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we've been talking about political hotspots, particularly the potential Russian spring in the last few weeks, and the idea that there's an innate desire for dignity among human beings, and that it goes beyond the political, though, doesn't it?
Oh, way beyond. I mean, I think it has to do with how we treat each other in every way, not only the kinds of societies we build, the kinds of states we build, but also the kinds of relationships we build, the kinds of communities we build, and recognizing the intrinsic dignity, worth, whatever, of every individual. I mean, you know that in the Torah there's a line, B'tzelem Elokim bara oto, that and every person is created in the image of God.
Right.
And if every person is godly, then he or she has a certain amount of dignity and worth, regardless of their position in life, regardless of their abilities, their age, their appearance, et cetera, et cetera. So you can go two ways from here. One is that, as we've talked before, in terms of promoting tolerance and combating intolerance, it's really necessary to remind people, especially young people, all the time, that someone is not less worthwhile as a human being because they're the wrong color, the wrong height, the wrong shape, the wrong waist size, the wrong sexual orientation, whatever, that they still have the full dignity of every human being created in the image of God. And that's worth fighting for. On the other hand, there's an issue of what do you do with people who once were all-powerful and all-capable and who are losing it, either by virtue of age or dementia or change in their job scene, change in their family status, whatever. And I think a perfect example of this is the recent movie The Iron Lady, with the story of Margaret Thatcher, which is not so much the story of Margaret Thatcher politically. It appears to be that. I think one reason it was so disturbing to many viewers is that it's a story of an old woman losing it all. She's slowly losing her memory. She's slowly losing her ability to run a household. She's lost her political clout. She's out of power. She's lost her spouse. She's lost many of her lifelong companions, including her memories, which are companions also as we grow older. And how do people treat her? How do they react to her? How does the audience react? And I think that's an interesting study in an aspect of dignity that we often shy away from. Because guess what? We all have parents or had parents, and many of them, as they grow older, will lose some part of their faculties, physical, mental, their job, whatever takes up their time, whatever impassions, they're going to experience a sense of loss, and their children are going to have to deal with that. And I think our community resources could focus maybe a little more on helping children deal with the sense of loss that their parents go through before they actually lose their lives.
Yeah, it becomes an extended grief and mourning period, and it's nothing's more difficult, or one few things are more difficult than watching a parent gradually lose their capacity when they've been so important to your lives. You know, I thought of another irony, which is Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were in power largely in the same period of time. And both of them went through exactly this process of losing their memory, Alzheimer's, dementia, the same basic process.
Right.
We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We're delighted to have with us a special guest. She'll be our main guest next week, but the terrific Israeli-American singer, I'd like to claim her as American and Israeli, Noah Achinoam Nini, who will be here in Tucson quite soon. Pleasure to have you here. You've been sort of a musical heroine for me for a long time.
Thank you very much. I'm honored. Thank you.
You are engaged in a really wonderful collaboration with Mira Awad. Tell me how that started.
Started 12 years ago when I was interested in doing a collaboration with a Palestinian artist for one of my international albums. I met her. We recorded the Beatles song, We Can Work It Out, together. It was a wonderful success. And I then invited her to perform with me on stages throughout Europe. And finally, maybe the pinnacle of our relationship was when both of us represented Israel in the 2009 Eurovision Song Contest, and it was an amazing experience.
It's also an amazing YouTube cut, by the way, and I hope to be able to see that in person as well. Are you guys going to perform that?
Yes, we will perform that.
What's your favorite part about working with Mira Awad?
Well, she's an extraordinary person. She's a very, very talented singer and songwriter. She's also an actress and a graphic designer. She's been blessed with endless talent. We have a great chemistry between us, artistic chemistry, personal chemistry. We share the same views. We're friends. And it's really a pleasure sharing the stage with her.
You know, you've toured with Sting. You've performed with everybody from, I don't know, Sheryl Crow, Stevie Wonder, lots and lots of terrific performers. I think I still like your solo stuff the best. What do you like the best?
Collaborations are wonderful in the sense that they enrich you and they broaden your horizons, they give you different perspectives. But yeah, of course, just writing songs and performing them is my favorite part of the job. I do that in collaboration with Gil Dore, who has been my musical director now for 22 years, and he's an amazing musician, amazing person. We've made albums in English and Hebrew. I've recorded in Neapolitan and, of course, in Yemenite. And we've been blessed with the opportunity to perform all over the world. We're really lucky.
Well, we're looking forward to talking with you at greater length next week and hearing you soon. You'll be here at University of Arizona Centennial Hall next Sunday night. Thanks for this drop by, and we'll talk next week.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Hope to see you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Bernstein, retired, is resting peacefully on the porch of his small hotel outside Miami. When he sees a cloud of dust up the road, he walks out to see who could be approaching. It's a southern farmer with a wagon. "Good afternoon," says Bernstein. "Afternoon," says the farmer. "Where you're headed?" asks Bernstein. "Town." "What do you have in the wagon?" asks Bernstein. "Manure." "Manure, eh? What do you do with it?" "I spread it over the strawberries." "Well," says Bernstein, "you should come over here for lunch someday. We use sour cream." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. This week we begin the middle book of the Torah, Leviticus. The Hebrew name for this comes from its first word, Vayikra, God called. Leviticus is filled with ritual observances and rites designed to create and nurture sanctity. But it begins in an interesting and instructive way with a famous oddity about that very first word.
Vayikra, as it's written in the Torah, has a very small final letter, a reduced size Aleph, if you will, written much smaller than the other three letters of the word. Aleph, the Midrash tells us, is the first letter of the word Ani, I. Therefore, if we wish God to call us directly, we must similarly diminish our focus on the I and seek to limit our egotism. If we can do that, then we, like Moses, will be able to clearly hear God's call, respond, and so find the holiness that makes up the central subject of this book of Leviticus. Less of the I, and so more of God. Only when we diminish the centrality of our self-absorption can we allow God in. Leviticus focuses on the way our ancestors worshipped God through animal sacrifices, korbanot. For the past 1900 years since the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem, prayer and study and acts of charity and repentance have replaced sacrifice. These are all ways to open ourselves to God and diminish our emphasis on the self. Perhaps even more importantly, Vayikra teaches us that God requires us to give up something in order to find holiness and meaning in life. While ethical living, prayer, religious experience, and the study of Torah have replaced the ancient sacrifices, the message that we need to give up something in order to find something much greater remains central. Sacrifice in the Torah was a way to connect us to the fact that our own existence is holy only when we offer ourselves to God. As Samson Raphael Hirsch says, the sanctuary of God's Torah demands the full, complete life with nothing left out, nothing missing, and promises in exchange a rich, full life in which even death and pain lose their sting. By giving up something, a bit of our self-importance, and committing to dedicating energy and time to holy purpose, we will give our own lives meaning and sanctity well beyond our own reach. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Professor and Rabbi Michael Morgan, will explain some options for Jewish belief here in the 21st century and how they impact our lives when we return on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
So sometimes the truth really does come out. You see, it turns out that a Palestinian boy accidentally struck by a bullet, who eventually died of his injuries last week, was killed not by an Israeli airstrike, but by Palestinian terrorists firing in the air during a funeral. Palestinian health official Adam Abu Salmiya of the Hamas group initially said that 8-year-old Barka al-Mughrabi died of wounds sustained in an Israeli airstrike last week. However, the IDF did not carry out a strike in the area at that time. The boy's relatives and witnesses later said the boy was marching in a funeral procession for a Gaza terrorist when he was actually struck in the head by an errant bullet fired by Palestinian gunmen. Very sad. In other developments, Israel and Gaza's Hamas-Palestinian terrorists agreed to a truce after 4 days of cross-border firing, although there have since been lots of violations. Not counting the boy, 25 Palestinian terrorists were killed in the violence. However, in spite of the current truce, rocket and mortar fire from Gaza continue into civilian areas of Israel, and Israel has continued to carry out retaliatory airstrikes. Originally, terrorist groups in Gaza began launching a barrage of rockets on March 9th after Israel assassinated Zuhir Musa Ahmed Haisi, leader of the Popular Resistance Committees in Gaza. The IDF believed he was planning a terrorist strike in Israel. Over 200 rockets were fired from Gaza into Israel, including the large Grad rockets now being smuggled into Gaza for Hamas to use through tunnels coming in from Egypt. Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, the author and media personality, TV guy and radio guy too, and two-time Two Jewish guest, I might add, announced his candidacy for a New Jersey congressional seat last week. Boteach announced he will be seeking the Republican nomination in northern New Jersey's 9th congressional district. Boteach previously said he was considering running. The Democratic-leaning northern New Jersey district has a fierce redistricting-induced Democratic primary battle taking place now between two incumbents, Representatives Bill Pascrell and Steve Rothman. Shmuley Boteach's stated platform includes support for school vouchers, a flat tax, and making marital counseling tax deductible in order to lower the divorce rate. That's probably a good idea, that one. He has criticized what he sees as an excessive Republican focus on sexual issues like gay marriage. Boteach once was affiliated with Chabad. He now bills himself as America's rabbi. Imagine that. He hosts a show on TLC called Shalom in the Home. He's the author of several books, including Kosher Sex, Kosher Adultery, the Kosher Sutra, and most recently, Kosher Jesus. And finally, Woody Allen will apparently play a pimp who arouses the suspicions of his Hasidic neighbors in a movie to be directed by actor John Turturro. Allen is set to co-star in the Fading Gigolo film, along with Turturro and Sharon Stone, Variety reported. Turturro and Allen will play friends who spark the suspicions of their Hasidic neighbors when they launch this gigolo business. In the film, believe it or not, Allen serves as Turturro's pimp. Allen recently won an Academy Award for screenwriting for Midnight in Paris, which was delightful. He rarely appears in any other director's movies, or actually not in his own very much anymore. According to Variety, he last appeared in another filmmaker's movie way back in 2000 with a role in the comedy Picking Up the Pieces in an uncredited cameo in Company Man. And he's back, this time as a gigolo. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish This Morning our guest, the distinguished professor and rabbi, Dr. Michael Morgan, who has been one of the most prominent Jewish studies professors in the country for, I hate to say this, but decades now. He's written 16 books and many, many articles. Originally got his doctoral degree in philosophy from the University of Toronto. His rabbinical ordination from Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion was at the University of Indiana for many years, Indiana University. Michael, we started talking a little bit about Buber and Rosenzweig. You have also written and are going to speak Thursday, March 22nd, University of Arizona, on Emmanuel Levinas and Judaism. I have read a great deal of Jewish thought, and I've read a fair amount of Emmanuel Levinas. I just can't say I've understood him. Can you explain him simply to our audience?
Uh, Well, I can say some things that I think are accurate about him. I don't know how well I'll be able to communicate kind of the core of his thinking in just a few sentences, but I'll give it a try. I think personally that Levinas is an extraordinarily opaque writer. He makes it awfully, awfully difficult for those who aren't brought up in a tradition of reading his style of writing to make sense of it. In one of the books that I wrote on Levinas, I start by indicating that I was first introduced to him by some friends years and years and years ago, and I tried to read him several different times, and I just couldn't make anything of it. I kept putting it down until finally it seemed to be necessary to read him, and I forced myself to read a great deal and to step back and ask myself what was going on here, what was he really talking about. One of the things that Levinas is known for having said is that ethics is first philosophy, and that ethics is primary to human existence and human experience. And I think that if we can understand what he means by that, then at least we've begun to figure out what he's all about. First of all, by ethics, he doesn't mean moral rules or our sense of what obligations apply to us in a given situation. He doesn't mean moral choices of very particular kind in particular situations about life and death issues or about social justice or something like that. By ethics, he means a certain way of understanding the human situation and human existence as fundamentally a social experience in which one particular individual is related to another particular individual. So ethics is about what I call the social relationship, or the social, to begin with. Furthermore, his conviction is that not only is our life sort of foundationally related to others in this way, but that relationship has deep within it, in every single case, a kind of a core that makes a claim upon us, that calls out to us in some particular way. So that no matter how it is that we're related to other people, no matter how far they are from us or close to us, no matter what the particular situation, we're always nonetheless related to each and every other person in this very normatively compelling way. Now, he says ethics is first philosophy. He's a philosopher. In the tradition of Western philosophy, the first philosophy was metaphysics in classical antiquity, in Aristotle and those who followed him. In the Middle Ages, first philosophy was theology. After Descartes, first philosophy is a kind of is epistemological inquiry into knowledge and the foundations of knowledge and things like that. So lots of people have had different views about what the most fundamental philosophical kind of inquiry is that kind of gets us started and provides us with our foundations. And what Levinas's point is not that there is nothing that's foundational, right? There are lots of figures in the 20th century who have said, well, there are no foundations. We just kind of pick our way of talking or our particular culture, and we just engage with each other and such things. And that's not Levinas. For Levinas, there are things that are fundamental, but what it is that's fundamental is this kind of fact of our social relationship that is very particularized with each and every other person, and it's the dimension of it that makes a claim on us from at the beginning, so to speak. And everything else that we're involved with in engaging with other people is a response to that claim, and then a development of it or an expression of it or such things. So from a practical point of view, what Levinas is saying is that things like this, he's saying we may have policies that personal ones or communal policies or public legal policies or something about how we treat certain classes of people and such things. For Levinas, he wants us to remember that no matter that in every situation in which we act, our actions are responsive to the needs and the claim and the very existence of particular other people. We should never forget that. Rules, policies sometimes make us, they inure us to the reality of the fact that what we do affects particular other people. So that's part of it. And the other part of it is that the claim is there first, and we're always negotiating those claims. Right? So justice is a matter of figuring out what we can do and what we can't do, but it always starts out with the fact that we must do something.
So that imperative is there. It's that whole relational concept, the very powerful notion, we're all connected. And Levinas draws on lots of Jewish sources, although in some ways it seems he moves in a direction that's almost independent of the Jewish influence on his work.
Right.
Now, speaking about somebody else who's very hard to read, but Franz Rosenzweig, who's one of my favorite figures in Jewish thought, and I love reading about Rosenzweig, and I love the stories about Rosenzweig so much more than I like reading actual Rosenzweig. He really sets the tone for Jewish existentialism in the 20th century and shapes the way lots of Jews end up reacting to their own Judaism, maybe even more than Buber, who has the best known book of Jewish theology, I and Thou. How does one read Rosenzweig?
Yeah, that's a real challenge. Rosenzweig is a tremendous challenge. As you say, he's fundamental. I think that he increasingly over these last several decades has received greater and greater and greater attention, both within Jewish circles, but also, perhaps even more importantly, outside of Jewish circles or outside of the area of Jewish studies, that is, by people who are interested in the intellectual history and kind of 20th century thought generally, Rosenzweig has just become an increasingly important figure. Rosenzweig wrote a lot of what he wrote for people of the very same mind, so to speak, his conversation partners, the people who knew all the references and the background literature and whatever. I think Rosenzweig wasn't thinking of being, intentionally cryptic. He just was writing for a very sophisticated kind of audience, and he, the Star of Redemption. He jokes about the fact that people bought it after it came out in 1921-22, but that it wasn't being read. It was people were putting it on their coffee table. So people were talking about the book, but nobody had read it. And that they were confused about the book. They thought that it was a Jewish book and that by buying it, it was going to tell them something about Jewish holidays and Jewish observance, and Jewish practice, a kind of, a reader's guide to...
To Judaism.
To Judaism, right.
It was going to be the idiot's guide to Judaism of the 1920s.
Judaism for Dummies or something.
This coming Thursday, March 22nd, you'll talk about Emmanuel Levinas and Judaism at the University of Arizona. Friday night, March 23rd, at Temple Emmanuel, you'll talk about Franz Rosenzweig's conception of Judaism. And Saturday, March 24th at noon, Emil Fackenheim's Legacy, and talk about post-Holocaust theology. I want to thank Professor Michael Morgan for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Wish we could go on longer, but my producer is signaling frantically. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Well, very good. It's been great to talk with you and see you very shortly.
Thank you, Michael. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Two Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be the terrific Israeli-American singer Noah Achinoam Nini, who will be performing here in Tucson on Sunday night next at Centennial Hall. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Passover preview. It's Dayenu from the fun CD Reggae Passover. My friends, have a great day, Shavua Tov, and a week, we pray, of peace.